Hub
and Spoke Audio Collective.
In 1610, 3 years after Jamestown was founded and a decade before Plymouth was, Mars was glimpsed through a telescope for the first time. Galileo squinted skyward, and it was the first time in history that Mars, which had been known and understood for centuries, seemed to get a bit closer while remaining impossibly far away. As close as we've gotten in the intervening centuries, as much as we've learned, the red planet is an icon that vexes us as much as it vexed those long ago 17th century people who first saw it up close. This month, July 2018, Mars's orbit brings it as close as it's been to us since 2003. It won't be this close again until 2035. It's still, like, really freaking far away. But there's something about these moments when Mars dances so near our orbit that it outshines everything else in the night sky. It's sort of tempting us, teasing us. Is it flirting with us? This past weekend in Texas, we flirted back. Me, my wife, her family. We saw Mission Control. We drove by the Orion offices where they're planning the first manned mission to Mars. We touched a Martian rock. This is Iconography, and I'm Charles Gustine, your guide on this tour of icons real and imagined. This episode, our tour of the icons that have defined New England, takes a detour. Just a few million miles, and then we'll be back in New England, I swear. There's two reasons that we're clicking away from our regularly scheduled programming for an episode. One is kind of pedestrian. I'm hard at work cooking up the next batch of episodes on Plymouth and its icons. Squanto, Mayflower, The Rock, Thanksgiving. And well, they're still in the oven. I don't want to pull them out too early. The bird needs a little bit longer in there. The second reason is a bit more romantic. This past weekend, for the first time in months, I flew out of the Northeast for a spell, and the world was new. The streets were wide, the air was sticky, the parking was ample. The Mexican bakeries were the size of auditoriums, and my hands smelled powerfully of barbecue sauce. I expected to fly out of Boston, sleep, attend a wedding, sleep, and return. I had a cultural experience instead. As of 6 months ago, I don't just live in New England. I podcast about New England. My dreams are New England. Because of Iconography, it's been a few months since I've read a book that wasn't about 17th century English settlers. That's not a complaint. I love setting out on this journey through New England's dreamscape, one icon at a time. It's not unlike what happens to any person when they move to a cool new place like Boston. You get immersed, you educate yourself so you don't say Worcester wrong in front of your new friends, and during those heady early days, the outside world starts to fade away, and your mind pulses in rhythm to the sitco sign. But inevitably, the spell is broken, even for a moment, and a message gets in from the outside world. This message comes from out of this world. I sent it 4 years ago.
Welcome. I'm Charles Gustine, and this is episode 1 of Context Sensitive. This week, The Martian Chronicle.
While I work on my newest long-form scripted piece of audio on Squanto, I'm going to go ahead and cue up the first long-form scripted piece of audio I ever made. Back in October of 2015, when Matt Damon and Ridley Scott and The Martian had us all psyched about Mars. Why now? Because I just visited the Johnson Space Center and I'm psyched about Mars. I mean, Mars is up there so close, winking at us right now. So for one episode, while I prepare our visit to Plymouth, let's take a moment to zoom out. Way, way out. And consider this. There are some icons that evoke a certain culture, and there are some icons, very few, that transcend culture, that belong to all of us, unite us. Whether you're in New England or England, Houston or Houston, we all look up at Mars and wonder when it will be within our reach. This is an episode about that feeling.
This is.
Come as quite a shock to my crewmates and to NASA and to the entire world, but I'm still alive. Surprise.
That tittering you hear behind Matt Damon is the live studio audience at James Corden's Late Late Show. Corden and Damon are quick-changing through the star's filmography. While Damon is doing his pitch for his upcoming release, The Martian, Corden stumbles out dressed as a little green man.
Greetings, Earthlings. Welcome to my planet.
What are you doing?
We haven't seen the movie yet. The Martian doesn't come out until Friday.
It's a silly joke, but I have to admit, for all these years that I've been vaguely aware of The Martian as a best-selling novel, I had assumed it definitely would contain some mysterious encounters with, well, you know.
Yes. Very curious. Very interesting. I do so enjoy observing the flora and fauna of that tiny planet.
Assuming a story about Mars must feature Martians isn't all that loony when you dig deep. Let's relish the understated irony, and take a moment to admire the tongue author Andy Weir must have planted firmly in his cheek. A film called The Martian may very well be the first high-profile Mars feature to not feature even a passing mention of Martians. Here's a fun game. Go to the Wikipedia page, List of Films Set on Mars, and see how long it takes for each film on the list to reveal the red planet's aboriginal inhabitants.
3, 2, 1.
Some are obvious right off the bat. It, the terror
from beyond space.
Ghosts of Mars and Santa Claus Conquers the Martians are obviously, sometimes absurdly, about dealing with native colonies. But even films that seem to be relatively grounded stories about explorers eking out survival amidst a deserted, desolate wasteland reveal ancient civilizations in surprise third-act twists. Films like Stranded, Robinson Crusoe on Mars, and, infamously, the well-known Brian De Palma Project Mission to Mars obfuscate their endgame.
So somebody left that thing here. Somebody other than human.
Total Recall, which features all sorts of kooky mutants but not a single living Martian, seems to defy this. But remember, the MacGuffin is an ancient artifact left behind by a long-gone civilization.
Start the reactor.
Inevitably, with an exception here or there, none of them particularly notable, every movie set on Mars eventually reveals an imposing civilization of many-limbed, big-eyed humanoids. Or a dangerous infestation of insects or parasites. Or an artifact abandoned by a long-gone race. Films about the Red Planet have seemed always to take one thing as doctrine. Who's gonna watch a movie about Mars if it doesn't have Martians? Without them, it's just dust. And desolation. But after years of high-profile financial failures, especially once Disney, fearing a repeat of Mars Needs Moms, effectively banished the word Mars from appearing in the title of Andrew Stanton's adaptation of A Princess of Mars, only to have the blandly titled John Carter still become a resounding maelstrom of bad press and financial catastrophe. After all this, the doctrine seemed to have changed to, who's gonna watch a movie about Mars? Context Sensitive is a podcast that looks at a major cultural milestone and wonders, how did we get to this moment, and what does it mean that we're here? I'm Charles Gustine, and the big question I'm setting out to wrestle in this, our first episode, now that Ridley Scott's The Martian is a bona fide phenomena and a serious awards contender, can we finally put Mars back in movie titles again? Part 1. Lost in Space. The closest comparison point for The Martian is not any previous movie set on Mars, preoccupied as they are with
life on Mars.
No, both temporally and thematically, the obvious starting point is recent hit and award stalwart Gravity, the elegant, svelte, fast-paced masterwork that The Martian nearly unseated in the race for largest opening weekend ever in October. There are obvious differences when you dig in. Alfonso Cuarón's Rube Goldberg machine of clashing debris is primarily a showcase for Emmanuel Lubezki's mastery with a digital camera, and for Sandra Bullock, who is the only character for the majority of the film. It takes place across 90 hectic minutes. It is about finding the strength within oneself to push on when all seems lost and the other side beckons comfortingly. The Martian touches on those elements, especially early on when astronaut Mark Watney is stranded without any ability to communicate, everyone assuming him dead. But, as the story progresses across months and months, Matt Damon sees the spotlight. The Martian prizes the perspectives of all sorts of NASA professionals. Fellow crew members mourning Mark on the return journey, executives facing public relations nightmares and impossible decisions, finicky geniuses running astrophysics calculations while sipping cold coffee at 3 in the morning.
Right now, the Hermes is headed towards you, starting its month-long deceleration to intercept. But instead, what I'm proposing is... we start accelerating immediately to preserve velocity and gain even more. We don't intercept with Earth at all, but we come close enough to get a gravity assist and adjust course.
The Martian becomes a film about collaboration, professionalism, problem solving, and the drive to keep exploring in spite the apparent risk involved. Sandy's Dr. Ryan Stone was presented as an inexperienced novice, banking on lucky breaks and spiritual hallucinations to sneak through an impossible tempest. That tempest could not be scienced. It could merely be persevered through. At the end of the film, she's presented as having gained strength and inner peace from her ordeal, sure. But one doubts she will be running the candidate program for NASA, telling hopefuls it was all worth it and sending them on their way into orbit. Watney is different. Confident, assured, and always aware that what he's gone through, being marooned on Mars, was always a possibility. It's not what he would have hoped for, but it is what he signed up for. On the surface, though, sure, these two cultural touchstones in the recent annals of speculative fiction, calling them science fiction seems deceptive since they both postulate events based firmly on science fact, they toy with the same monster under our collective bed, the overwhelming fear of being stranded in the sheer vastness, the unforgiving cold, the vacuum that is space.
Explorer, do you copy?
Part 2. In space, someone might hear you scream if they work really hard and collaborate well.
Houston, do you copy? Houston, this is Mission Specialist Ryan Stone. I am off structure and I'm drifting. Do you copy?
The isolation genre of space movies tends to work best when it is divorced from the more fantastical elements of science fiction. Namely, aliens. Because think about it, having aliens out there means that the universe isn't lonely and sparse. It's crowded with unknown wonders. Maybe those wonders are hostile. Maybe those wonders presented the seed for humanity millions of years ago. Regardless of their temperament, they tend to take away the one thing you need to make space feel isolating and unwelcoming. You know, space. Elbow room. It's why the best films about troubleshooting catastrophes impossible distances from home tend to be based on fact, like Ron Howard's Apollo 13, or work relatively fact-adjacent, like Gravity and The Martian. When we think about Gene Roddenberry's Wagon Train to the Stars, or George Lucas's Samurai Space Opera, we don't imagine a universe uncompromising in its solitude. Instead, what endears those universes to us so is that they seem to feature endless possibilities to run into the fuzzy, the slimy, or the power mad. Adventure lurks around every corner. Even when Kirk is abandoned by Spock on an uninhabited ice planet, it doesn't take him long to find first a fearsome beast, then the wizened alternate reality version of his rival, and then a wisecracking Scottish ally and his sidekick. In a nutshell, one thread of space movies trades on your fear of being abandoned in a lonely vacuum with no hope. The other thread makes vivid your dream that we are not alone. There is a film, though, that knits these disparate threads together. It makes the universe feel mythic in the thrilling unknowability of those dark corners that could contain anything, even an alien. It is also the film that best encapsulates to this day how terrifying we find the idea of space. We cannot breathe in it. If something goes wrong within the constructs we've created to inhabit it temporarily, we cannot go outside to find solace. Outside is death. We are trapped. As its tagline famously conveyed, in space, no one can hear you scream. Ridley Scott's Alien is a harsh film. It is not a film that could end in the OJ's love train. There are certainly Ridleyan touches dotted throughout The Martian. Scott's focus on Watney healing his own puncture wound is a visceral double for his most iconic film moment, the chestburster. And Scott does what Weir cannot. He shows us how emaciated Watney is a year into his ordeal. But The Martian is, on the whole, an elegiac ode to hope, good-humored sarcasm, and camaraderie. Dramatic understatement time. Before The Martian, Scott is not a director to whom you would have typically turned for uplift. Scott's most popular films embrace bleak ambiguities. Ripley's escape from the xenomorph in Alien isn't played as some triumphant fist-pumping moment like James Cameron's.
Get away from her, you bitch!
It is a Pyrrhic victory.
I got you.
The Nostromo is lost, and you feel that. Good people are dead. Space will never be the same. This is prevalent across Scott's most iconic films. Think of the compromised positions characters like Thelma and Louise, Gladiator's Maximus, and Blade Runner's Deckard find themselves in at the conclusions of those films. Three of them lose their lives in a last hurrah. The fourth, well, it's uncertain whether he was alive to begin with. At Vox, Peter Sunderman hits on why Weir's novel may have struck a chord with what optimism Scott does have. Weir is an optimist, and Scott is definitely not. Indeed, Scott recently said that he thinks humanity is probably doomed in the near future. That's not entirely surprising from the director of some of the darkest movies ever made. It's not an accident that his previous film, The Counselor, was a collaboration with Cormac McCarthy, another storyteller whose work evinces a deep pessimism about human nature. But it does point to a tension in his work, which is often bleak in tone but tends to end in individual triumph. Ultimately, Scott is both a nihilist and a humanist, someone who has little hope in humanity, but a surprising amount of faith in the abilities of individual humans to survive. The tension between Scott's broad pessimism and his narrow optimism is a big part of what makes his best movies, and The Martian is one of them. So, great. Still, this is not a man who has grown kinder to his characters as he's grown older. If you saw The Counselor, and you probably did not, you know this. We don't have to extrapolate much to prove this. Only 3 years ago, Scott returned to the Alien universe for the first time since he was 40 and known mainly as the director of stylish commercials. The result, the prequel Prometheus, showed that Scott has only gotten more nihilistic. Prometheus seemed to imply what the first Alien did not, that most of its characters deserved their horrid fates. Those two stone doofuses didn't know what they'd signed up for. Vickers, the Ice Queen, is an avatar for corporate greed. And those two dreamers who wanted to solve the mystery of where humanity came from should have just left well enough alone. The crew of the Prometheus never gets along, never trusts each other, and does not pull through. So what changed? What has allowed a director like Scott to make an astronaut film about how terrifying the abyss is, but to find in that abyss hope, love, camaraderie? Part 3, Mysteries of #Gravity.
Ever since our species first looked up at the sky, we've dreamed of reaching Mars. Back in 2029, that dream became real when the first humans set foot on the Red Planet.
Look, it's not as if The Martian does not feature adversity. It is a film all about adversity and humanity's capacity for handling it. What's notably missing is the adversity that comes from people sucking. From malice. From ineptitude. From ignorance. You know, the stuff that was all over Prometheus. Everyone in The Martian is good at their job. Everyone is trying their best and working towards what they believe to be the best interest of humanity and Mark Watney. Everyone is trying to counter a desolate planet that stymies not because it hates them, but because it is not meant for them to inhabit without hard work and improbable feats of ingenuity. The Martians started as a hobby. Andy Weir was not a NASA employee. He was a computer programmer with spare time, an avid reader and user of Google who wondered what it would take to get us to Mars, and what it would take to keep us there. What's the worst possible scenario for a human on Mars? The Martian asks. Everything goes wrong. Survival is a far-off dream. Now, let's do the math. And the math is right.
I thought it was pretty excellent. Certainly one of the most realistic books on Mars that I've read. I mean, there were a few things, like the wind force on Mars is not really that high. It's high, obviously high velocity, but low force.
Yes, you're right. The sandstorm is unrealistic. That was a deliberate sacrifice of accuracy for dramatic purposes.
That was Elon Musk, the figurehead for our eventual Mars colonization, followed by a response from The Martian's author, Andy Weir. Weir admits he took some poetic license here and there, but only to get eyeballs to this story, to get people pumped about space travel. Which has worked, clearly. All the more remarkable because the appeal of The Martian is hard science, precisely calibrated calculations, and the dream of a bright future for a U.S. space program that has recently looked like it's a long way from sending astronauts to other celestial bodies.
One of the things that was really important to me in writing this was I wanted everything to be as scientifically accurate as possible. So for starters, all the technology mentioned in the book is real. It takes place in a slight future, so some of the technology is much more efficient or much more effective than the versions of it we have now. But it all actually exists. And what I'm going to talk to you today about, being a Google crowd, I thought you might be interested in some software I wrote to make one part of it as accurate as possible. It has to do with the way that Hermes got from Earth to Mars and back. Hermes is an ion engine ship, and for those of you who don't know what ion engines are, I mean, I described it briefly in the chapter, but basically, instead of a chemical propellant going out the back of the ship providing a large amount of impulse, it's a very small amount of acceleration caused by magnetic fields throwing ions out the back of the ship. Now, the benefit to this is that you can have much, much, much less reactant mass, and I believe, and this is just my own subjective opinion, we have to improve on the technology that we have and just keep working that. I think that's the only way we'll be able to send humans long distances out into space.
Weir, who you just heard speaking at Google, initially published The Martian on his website, for free. Through the encouragement of enthusiastic friends and readers, Weir found a publisher, then found himself a bestseller. It's hard to imagine Weir's gambit working in an age without a figure like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who you heard earlier espousing the virtues of Weir's fictional Ares crew. Tyson, who is the director of the Hayden Planetarium, among many, many other things, is a social media star. He hosts a radio show, Star Talk, that you can download on iTunes. He's hosted a television show. He's hosted a YouTube show. He's chums with Stephen Colbert.
He's one of the most prominent proponents of Pluto's demotion from a real planet to a dwarf planet. Boy, I tell you, I would love to hear what Neil has to say now. Neil, what do you have to say now? Do you have anything to say about this? Are you excited?
I'm excited.
On a scale of 1 to awesome, how awesome is this?
I would say awesome minus 10%.
He is who we turn to when we get pretty pictures of Pluto and wonder what they mean.
If Neptune were a Chevy Impala parked at the curb,
yeah,
ask yourself, what car would Pluto be?
If Neptune was a Chevy Impala
parked at the curb.
Parked at the curb.
Yeah. What car can you think up that Pluto would be?
A matchbox car.
That's exactly what it would be.
Car. Matchbox car.
Oh.
Tyson's gentle ribbing about scientific inaccuracies in gravity, example tweet, mysteries of hashtag gravity, Nearly all satellites orbit Earth west to east, yet all satellite debris portrayed orbited east to west. Well, excuse my hyperbole here, but those tweets, they kind of stopped the internet for a bit. Which feels like a pretty recent phenomena, right? This ability serious scientific discussion has to make millennials stop what they're doing and surrender their brain space for however long it takes Tyson to impart his wisdom. Like a cat video with a PhD. This is the age of the TED Talk, of the graying scientist in bow ties who does Reddit AMAs and Josh's talk show hosts. Tyson may be rivaled in this sense only by Bill Nye, who knows his way around the brain of a millennial, having ingrained in so many of those brains this fact, that inertia is, yes, a property of matter. Nye had a bit of a head start with children of the 80s and 90s. Tyson is catching up fast. They are the leading lights in an attempt to reach future scientists where they are on a daily basis. On YouTube, on BuzzFeed, on Hulu, and Reddit, and Twitter. They may only impart bite-sized nuggets of knowledge, but their message is always clear. Seek out more information. We need an informed populace. The only way we can save our planet is to keep striving, to learn, to do good. The only way we can get to new planets is to keep striving, to learn, to do good.
The first thing we want to do is to continue explore Mars with our robots, with our spacecraft. But what you want to do is send people there, because people explore so much faster than the robots that we can create. It's estimated that what a human does in 5 minutes, a robot does in a week. When you go exploring, you will make discoveries, and you will have an adventure. You will have adventures that will engage everyone in the world, in the same way this movie that's coming out will engage people. But it will be real. And as far as business models and big ideas for entrepreneurship, we take the examples from history of Magellan, Columbus, Lewis and Clark, Henry Hudson.
Is there risk involved? Sure. Every one of the litany of explorers Bill Nye just mentioned did things previously thought unthinkable, undoable, and experienced incredible hardship. But we are crafted characters in The Martian who understand that hardship was part of the risk. They understand that they trained for years to handle that risk, but that they also trained for years to discover. To push. Not once do Weir's characters express remorse that they have put their lives on hold or put their lives on the line for the sake of scientific advances. This is the battle at the heart of The Martian, the battle that must always be going on in Weir's NASA director, Teddy Sanders, head. There is the ambivalence we feel, politicians feel, benefactors feel, when it seems like the risks outweigh the benefits. But there is the giddy rush of excitement we feel when the inverse is true.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Oh, that looks beautiful from here.
When NASA isn't synonymous in the public imagination with budget cuts, but with the image of a room full of scientists thrilled at the fruits of their labor, touching down safely.
UHF is good. Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
If you're looking for the perfect companion piece for The Martian, the wine to round out the flavors in this meal, if you want to see another movie that matches the mood of this moment, when pictures of Pluto and water on Mars set our hearts aflutter and rekindle our dreams of inhabiting other planets and finding life, then look not to Gravity, or Mission to Mars, or, God forbid, Alien or Prometheus. Instead, find Europa Report. You can do this right now. It's streaming on Netflix.
We keep looking for the answers to those really tough questions. Who are we? Where do we come from? And are we alone?
Europa Report is a found footage film. I know, but it works, and there's a really effective twist surrounding its use. About a crew of 6 astronauts who set out for a moon orbiting Jupiter that might just have the potential for life. Early in their journey, a technical malfunction knocks out communication with Earth, so every discovery they make has the potential to be lost with them. The lengths they go to when all seems lost to ensure that every discovery they've made can be shared with Earth? Well, I don't want to spoil a movie you probably haven't seen right after I tell you to see it, but it's one of cinema's great statements about what it really means to... Well, Matt Damon, would you finish that thought for me?
Science the shit out of this.
Part 4. Wither Barsoom.
Welcome to the International Space Training Center. You're here today to train for the greatest adventure in the history of mankind. The exploration of deep space.
Brian De Palma's mission to Mars may not be fondly remembered, or remembered that much at all, today, but you and millions of others have probably experienced it in bastardized form.
You're here today for flight training, the most thrilling experience that any astronaut candidate will ever have.
As you prepare to board Epcot's Mission Space, you are briefed on your mission by one of the stars of Mission to Mars, Gary Sinise, in what you realize is one of the stranger, more orphaned bits of Disney cross-promotion you can encounter. Strange because what's notably different about your 5-minute, not counting hypersleep, which you don't remember, do you, journey to Mars is that upon landing, you are not presented, as De Palma's characters were, with a civilization claiming to be the source of humanity offering you a chance to hang with them and peek behind the veil. Getting to Mars, being on Mars, that's considered enough to satisfy you, the Disney consumer. Think about how weird the alternative would be, though. The point of Mission Space is immersion. You, yes, even you, can feel like you are being launched into space. You wake from hypersleep and there it is below you, Mars. You dodge and swerve between red crevices and make a remarkable landing at the edge of a cliff. And there, waiting to greet you is a regal Martian emissary? That moment of dissonance you would feel trying to mush together the real Mars with the Mars of fairy tales? Well, maybe that's part of why the slow trickle of Mars movies that have come out over the past few decades have been such ignominious flops. That can't be the whole reason, obviously. Audiences gobble up stuff they're savvy enough to not believe in all the time. People who don't believe there are monsters in their closets still love Monsters Incorporated. John Carter, which is a really nifty movie, by the way, didn't flop because people don't think there are tharks out there. It flopped because its marketing campaign was awful. But considering how the majority of the populace feels about the possibility of life on Mars circa 1990 to today, the fact that just about every Mars film released in that time snuck in aliens somewhere... It's like if every film about Mexico in that same time span were about the chupacabra. Even films that don't seem like they would be about the chupacabra, films that seem like they were grounded takes on real Mexico, suddenly in the third act, they were about the chupacabra. Look, Martians may very well be real, but right now, even with the discovery of water on Mars, they are as real as the chupacabra. That wasn't always the case. There was a time at the turn of the 20th century when it seemed just about inevitable that we would find intelligent life out there. Mars had canals! It was Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli's announcement that he had observed canali on Mars that cinched the deal. The name Schiaparelli gave the dark lines he saw on the Martian surface actually means channels, but when reported in English it was rendered as canals. Channels can be natural, canals are artificial. And 1877 was part of an era when man-made canals were very much in the public consciousness. If there were canals on Mars, well, surely there must be canal builders as well. Surely there must be Martians. That's George R.R. Martin talking about the lost romance of old Mars, the Mars of Edgar Rice Burroughs, in an op-ed in The Guardian. And look, you have no idea how much I wish I had the audio of George reading this, by the way. You'll just have to make do with me. That was the Mars of the imagination, when the world thought that Schiaparelli's canals must have meant civilizations were out there waiting for us to reach them. If Andrew Stanton's John Carter had come out in 1938, it would have been... everything. Superman was inspired by John Carter, after all, and he did pretty well for himself that year. Because Barsoom was the Civil War past, yeah, but there was also the chance that it was the future. That somewhere down the line... we would meet those aliens, and we would coexist in Martian colonies. But when John Carter actually came out, in 2012? Look, maybe you, the contemporary listener, don't believe there's life in the universe anywhere but Earth. Fine. Even if you do believe there is that chance, even if you hope there is, you probably don't think that intelligent life is on Mars, snickering as it hides from our rovers and satellite pictures. And even if you do believe there's life on Mars waiting to be discovered, you must know it's not going to be photogenic, tall, strapping, and green like Martian Manhunter. George R.R. Martin on why he never wrote Game of Mars. Post-Mariner, when we talked about the possibility of life on Mars, we were talking about microbes or maybe lichen, though even lichen seemed to be pushing it, not sand mice and thoats. And while the discovery of Martian life would no doubt be electrifying to biologists and space scientists around the world, there has never been a microbe with the appeal of Dejathoris. Okay, it's sort of regressive to say that science, that the discovery of how things actually operated on distant worlds, the correction of long-held misconceptions, could actually set us back in some way. But, for kids who'd grown up on pulps about Mars and Venus, like George, a door was closed. Doors were open, too, and they're still being opened today. Some were opened just this month by hardworking scientists trying to unlock the secrets of Mars, but getting an up-close and personal look at what Mars was actually like meant that thousands of possible Mars disappeared. Mars as a cinematic destination has been stumbling toward a solution ever since. It was Mariner that put an end to the glory days of old Mars. The Mariner probes found no trace of cities, living, dead, or dying. No Tharks, no Thotes, no Martians of any hue or color. Lowell's network of artificial canals was not in evidence, and neither were Shear Pirelli's channels. Mariner's findings thrilled scientists around the world and gave us a detailed and accurate picture of the nature of the inner planets, but for the readers and writers of science fiction, the excitement was mingled with disillusionment and dismay. This was not the Mars we wanted. This was not the Venus of our dreams. I never wrote that Mars story, nor any stories on Venus or Mercury or any of the worlds of the lost solar system of my youth, the worlds that had provided the setting for so many wonderful tales during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. In that, I was not alone. After Mariner, our genre moved to the stars in a big way, searching for the colorful, exotic settings and alien races that could no longer be found here at home. The number of science fiction stories set on Mars and its sister planets declined sharply after Mariner. The real Mars was simply not as interesting as its pulp predecessor. Damn. George, that's a dagger. But, hey, you know, wait. This doesn't sound like a group of people uninterested in the realities of Mars as they compare to the possibilities of Barsoom.
It's already sending back pictures. Take a look at these pictures. We've got least a couple photos
really
already
Mars.
From the
not a science fiction movie.
I wonder what Einstein would have thought of this.
Technologies that NASA had never tried before.
Go NASA! JPL! Hoorah!
Hoorah!
Crater that it landed in.
If those comments from elders reacting to the Mars landing on the Fine Brothers channel tell us anything, if the past few months have shown us anything, it's that the real Mars can capture the attention of the populace. We find the real Mars fascinating, foreboding and welcoming in equal measure. It is both near and far. Pictures of its sandy plains both remind us of Earth's deserts and shock us with a hue of red we could never imagine existing here on Terra Firma. The Martian is a big hit. And it's a hit without even hinting at the entire deal we seem to have with Mars. You know, the ice caps, and the water those ice caps might promise, and the life that water might promise. The Martian was a rigorous exercise in taking Mars as science knew it right then at face value. And in that, it is thrilling. And wouldn't you know it, even in the few months since production wrapped, what we know about Mars has already changed. The real Mars just got more interesting.
Today we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
And who knows what NASA scientists could discover next.
If we were to discover life there, Lawrence, it would change everything. Everybody would feel differently about what it means to be a living thing.
All right, it's 2018, Charles, back with you again. This is the first time that this episode on Mars has ever been available on iTunes or an RSS feed. and I really hope that you've enjoyed it. Take some time this month while Mars is reaching out to us and just stare into the sky for a bit. You can tell me about your stargazing and planet gazing on Twitter at IconographyPod, on the Facebook page, facebook.com/iconographypodcast, and on the website where you can find show notes and a transcript of the episode. That's at iconographypodcast.squarespace.com. If you've been thinking, man, I really dig this podcast, could I ask you to do two little things for me? One, tell your people. Help get the word out about iconography. And two, rate and review the podcast on iTunes. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is on that one and recommend two podcast episodes to you that I've been thinking about a lot on the back of my trip to Houston. So as I said at the start of the season, Iconography is now a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a Boston-centric collective of smart, idea-driven podcasts. One of the founding shows of the collective is Soonish, in which host Wade Rausch asks what the world of tomorrow will look like. So Wade recently edited 12 Tomorrows, a collection of short stories in the hard science fiction genre, meaning they take science really seriously. So, no Martians. In a recent episode of Soonish, Science Fiction That Takes Science Seriously, Wade dives deeper into the paradox at the center of our little Martian adventure. He pushes at the relationship between science and fiction through interviews and a very engaging panel discussion with some of the authors behind 12 Tomorrows. It is a must-listen if this episode of Iconography got you thinking. Another founding Hub and Spoke show is The Lonely Palette, which sees host Tamar Avishai return art history to the masses. I am the masses, or I guess I was. And this show is a testament to the way that podcasts aren't just ear candy. They can change people. Before falling in love with The Lonely Palette, I am not someone who would have gone out of my way to see a room full of Mark Rothko paintings. But after hearing Meditations on Mark Rothko, Tamar's beautiful 24th episode of the show, I guess I became that person because I totally hijacked our family trip to Houston this weekend. When we all were collating our list of the must-dos in Houston, there were requests for the Johnson Space Center, there was Tex-Mex and barbecue, there was the Museum of Natural History and Science, and then there was me, waving my arms frantically in the corner, going, Rothko Chapel! Rothko Chapel! What is Rothko Chapel? Everyone else asked, perplexed. It's a small, non-denominational chapel filled from floor to ceiling with monolithic Rothko canvases meant to evoke a sense of mystic power and introspection. Now, they all had not listened to Meditations on Mark Rothko from The Lonely Palette. It was a hard-fought battle, but I did win. We all stopped in a picturesque, leafy neighborhood near Rice University, and I was swimming in Rothko's The Color of Water and The Color of Wine. It was stunning, and I have to say, if you're in Houston, definitely pay the chapel a visit. If you're not, do the next best thing, the equally best thing, and listen to The Lonely Palette. Check those episodes out at soonishpodcast.org and thelonelypalette.com respectively, or anywhere fine podcasts are available.